Today we've got Greg Oxley from the French section, actually an Englishman. But he's going to speak on the French Revolution. Trotsky once said that you couldn't understand the Russian Revolution without knowing about the French Revolution. So I'm looking forward to Greg's introduction. Greg will speak for about 50 minutes, plus 50 minutes translation. And hopefully we'll have plenty of time for contributions and questions. So without further ado, I'll hand over to Greg. He's got the unenviable task of trying to explain a very complicated period of history in only 50 minutes.
Well, comrades, Marx and Engels explained that the driving force of history is the development of the forces of production. When these forces come into contradiction with the existing social order, then begins an epoch of social revolution. And that was the essential task of the French Revolution. The basic historical cause for this revolution was the necessity to clear the way for capitalist development, to free the development of capitalist interest, capitalist property, and enable the achievements in productive technology of the time to be fully exploited. Now, to a large extent, the bourgeoisie was already a large part of the ruling class in France before the revolution. Capitalism had developed considerably under the Ancien Régime, under the old absolutist monarchy. But one of the tasks of the revolution was to subordinate the state to the interests of the bourgeoisie. And as we will see, that could not be done without destroying the privileges, or the liberties, as they were called, of the aristocracy. Now, this revolution took place not in a single act, but over at least 6 years. And even though it was a bourgeois revolution, in fact, it wasn't carried out by the bourgeoisie, really. This revolution was carried out by a mass movement of the most oppressed sections of society. It was a revolution which combined the movement of the urban poor, the lower classes in the towns, and the peasantry. It was also a mass movement of the poor peasants. And as we'll see, it was there the intervention of the poor in the town and the country, which at every stage of the revolution pushed the revolution further forward and enabled it to complete itself. Now, perhaps to make the understanding of the thread of events easier, I should just tell you what the main stages in this revolution were. Because so you could really say that it was not one revolution, but two revolutions, or at least two distinct phases of the revolution. Now that shouldn't surprise us, because it's actually a characteristic of just about all revolutions. So there are at least two main phases in a revolution. And the explanation for that is that because this is a movement of the oppressed, you can't have a revolutionary class which comes out of the darkness, if you like, which moves onto the political arena for the first time, and which moves constantly forward, overcoming all the obstacles it meets as it meets them. That's impossible. When the masses first move into action, they don't understand all the obstacles which they're up against. And when they meet these difficulties, it takes time for them to understand the nature of those difficulties and then move on to the next stage. So in the French Revolution, these two stages, the first stage begins in 1789, and really goes from July 1789 up until October of the same year, October 1789. That was when there was this mass march out towards Versailles to bring the royal family back to Paris. Their idea was to bring the royal family back under the control of the people, among the people, so they thought. And then after a gap, a lull in the revolution of about 20 months, there was a new revolutionary offensive. And that begins with the attempt of the king to leave Paris and join up with counter-revolutionary armies in the east of France. That was in June 1791. And the highest point of the revolution was expressed in the revolutionary dictatorship of August 1792, with the overthrow of the monarchy, until June 1794. Now, the other thing I would say is that this is not a national revolution. But it was simply the highest expression of a European revolutionary movement, and it was a direct threat not only to aristocratic interests in France, but also throughout the continent. And as you'll see, the revolution did not proceed, as I've already said, in a straight line, but it fluctuates. And these fluctuations in the revolution were largely determined by the counter-revolutionary threat internally, inside France itself, and internationally. Now, as I said, capitalism had developed to quite a high level under the old regime. And actually, this development of capitalism was encouraged and helped by the absolutist state, by the monarchy. The state used its resources to develop the textile industry, to develop shipbuilding. The maintenance of the army and the bureaucracy was quite a big market for capitalist interests. Shipbuilding and roads, all kinds of industries were developed with the help and with the encouragement of the state. But this economic development proceeded very unevenly. So in many ways you could say there were two Frances in 1789. It had the great ports and commercial centres like Nantes, Bordeaux. Marseille, Lyon, and of course Paris. Trade with Europe increased 5 times over the 100 years before the revolution. The working class did exist, but it was in a very kind of embryonic state. There were some concentrations of workers. There was a big textile factory up in the north that had 12,000 workers. A few thousand workers worked in the mining industry. And in Paris at that time, at the time of the revolution, there was probably about 500 factories or workplaces which employed anything between 100 and 600 or 700 employees. 500 workplaces. But one historian has described these workplaces as like industrial prisons, you know. It was almost like a kind of slave labor, very oppressed. So you had this capitalist France with its main industrial and commercial centers, and then side by side with that France was a France where feudal relations predominated. Serfdom had almost completely been abolished. I think it was just 2% of the peasants who were serfs. But nonetheless, there were lots of survivals from the old feudal times, and in particular the feudal rights which the aristocracy had, that is to say taxes which had to be paid by the poor and by the bourgeoisie to the aristocracy. Overall, the rural population was about 85% of the total population. 85% of the rural population. Agricultural population. And there were about 1 million vagrants, beggars if you like, landless peasants who had no means of earning a living. And in spite of the fact that serfdom was largely abolished, there were still about more than 1 million agricultural workers who they were called mains mortables, which meant that the local lords, the local aristocrats, had control over their persons. That is to say, they couldn't move out of that area, and their lives were basically completely under the authority of the lords. And so the land question and the question of poverty in the rural areas was one of the main forces, driving forces of the French Revolution. Now, the history of the French Revolution has been very controversial ever since it took place. And some historians argue that, well, society was developing, getting richer, capitalism was developing. There wasn't really a major problem under the old regime. This was a revolution of prosperity. This is what the argument is. And whilst it's true that there was a very important development of the economy before the revolution, in this economic development, there were winners and losers. The poor became poorer. The landless peasants moved into the towns to try and find work and didn't find any. The competition for work tended to drive down wages. When there were bad harvests, that would help the speculators and the rich because that increased the prices of grain, but it meant famine for the poor. And so the gap between the rich and the poor was growing. Now, as you probably know, under the old regime, the organisational basis of the old regime was the division of society into three orders. There was the nobility, the church, and then what was called the third estate. And the third estate basically is everybody who wasn't in the first two orders. But within these three orders, all three of them were cut across by class divisions. If we take the nobility, you had the upper nobility, the richest nobles. They were introduced into the court in Versailles. In Versailles, there was about 8,000 nobles lived at Versailles. They had a privileged position in terms of state contracts and pensions paid for by the monarchy. But at the other end of the nobility, the lower nobility, there was a general pauperization of the lower nobles. Who had been deprived of all their former attributes of local powers and had sometimes very little land. If you take the order of the church, it was the same situation. You had very powerful and wealthy bishops and archbishops, the kind of upper bureaucracy of the church. And then the poor priests who were living among the people in very similar conditions to the people themselves. And finally, the third estate was also divided. Because it included rich bankers, rich capitalists and tradesmen. It included people who'd made fortunes out of the slave trade. But it also included the poor in the cities and in the countryside. Now there was a young English agriculturalist called Arthur Young. And he went to France before the French Revolution, and he travelled all around France. He was interested in agricultural methods, techniques. And Arthur Young noted down everything he saw in a kind of a diary. And it's a very, very interesting book. It's called Travels in France. And he relates what he saw and what people told him as he travelled around. And in the writings of Arthur Young, you can just feel the kind of revolutionary mood and the anger which is building up among the poor peasants and among the urban poor. They could feel that their living standards were becoming more difficult, especially in times of bad harvests. And then the domination of society by this immense class of privileged aristocrats. Who didn't work, who didn't pay taxes, and who lived like kings. And so there was an explosive situation developing in society. And also, together with this social crisis, there was an ideological reflection of this social crisis in the writings of people like Jean-Jacques Rousseau, Saint-Simon, Diderot, Voltaire. These were great writers and publicists who they might not have been conscious revolutionaries, but what they said and what they wrote about the way society was organized struck a chord with the oppressed in society. And contributed to planting the seeds of revolutionary ideas and of the revolution itself. So those were the general causes of the French Revolution, but the more immediate cause was the financial crisis of the old regime. The monarchy, the state, had been involved in a series of wars. And the last of these wars, the war between the British and the Americans. The American War of Independence. France was involved in that war on the American side, supporting the Americans against the English. And that was a very important cause, which contributory cause to the French Revolution. For two reasons. First of all, the soldiers who went to the American War, when they came back, they explained what the ideas of the revolution in America. They'd participated in a war against the king for the overthrow of a monarchy, with the ideas of liberty, of democracy, of the sovereignty of the people. And these thousands of troops which came back from America had an effect on the psychology and the thinking of the urban poor in particular. And the second important consequence of the American war was to completely empty the state coffers. The state was bankrupt after this war. And the state was in had a complete financial crisis, no more money. And the question was, who will pay? Where would the regime get the money to pay these debts? The fact of the matter was that the poor could not pay, and the rich, or at least the aristocracy, because of their privileged position of not having to pay taxes, and a noble doesn't pay taxes, that's beneath him, so the poor couldn't pay and the rich wouldn't pay. Now, for many decades, even before the American War, there had been many attempts to reform the finances of the French state. The different king's ministers like Turgot, Necker, Calonne, and then again Necker, they tried to reform the law so that some money could be got from the aristocracy in order to help to finance the state. But they came against a complete wall of opposition from the aristocracy. They refused to pay. And one of these ministers deserves a particular mention, that's Necker. Because when he was up against the opposition of the nobility, and he was trying to gain support for reform. He actually published, for the first time, all the accounts of the state. And that meant for the first time people could see exactly where the money was coming from and what it was being spent on. This kind of lifted the veil of secrecy off the state finances. People could see these 20,000 people who had huge pensions, huge amounts of money being paid for them out of the coffers of the state. They could see how even the poorest sections of society were being made to pay for the church, for the landlords, and so on. And then again, they could see what the system really was, that in fact it was an entire machine directed against the poor for the oppression of the poor and the exploitation of the poor. Now, this crisis of finances brought the king, brought the court into conflict with the nobility. And it took the form of a struggle between the court and the king's minister and the parliament, in particular the Paris parliament. Now, the Parliament, the Paris Parliament, wasn't really a Parliament like we have today. In effect, it was a kind of a magistrate court. These were aristocrats, sometimes people, aristocrats by birth, sometimes people who bought positions, noble positions. And the role of the Paris Parliament was to ratify the decrees of the king, to make them into law. And the Parliament refused to ratify these attempts by the king to get extra resources from the nobility. The Parliament said they were defending their liberties. Now, what did they mean by liberties? They meant privileges, their privilege, the privilege not to pay taxes. And in the conflict between the Paris Parliament and the king, these magistrates, these nobles, involve the people and address themselves to the population. To try and agitate and put pressure on the monarchy. They said, look at the king and the way the king lives, and now he's attacking liberties, our liberties. And when the people saw this conflict in the ruling class, between different sections of the ruling class, they interpreted it in their own way, their idea of liberty. And for a time, the Parisian masses supported the Parliament, supported their own enemies, really, the nobles, against the king. And riots and demonstrations started to take place. This was a period of famine, of a shortage of bread. And the fact that rich and powerful people were now attacking the system, that had an effect on the masses and moved them into action. And this conflict was in an impasse. And finally, the king had no alternative but to call what was called the Estates General, which was a meeting of the representatives of the three orders. Now, you can imagine in this social and economic context of all the social discontent, the conflict, the demonstrations, the conflict between the Parliament and the king, the fact that now, for the first time since 1614, the Estates General was being convened, it focused the attention of the masses on this meeting. They were looking for a solution to their problems. Before the Estates General took place, people had filled in the cahier de doléances, the kind of notebooks of all their grievances and the problems they saw in the kingdom. And this was the idea. These people know what our problems are. Let's see what solutions they provide. So this raised enormous hopes. But these hopes were to be disappointed. The king insisted even though he had convened the Estates General to really as an arm against the nobility, once this conflict got beyond a certain point, he decided to support the nobility to put an end to this mass movement. And the crown insisted that the three orders should vote separately. So you would have the vote of the nobility, the vote of the church, and the vote of the third estate, which meant, of course, that the third estate was in a minority, whatever happened. And because of this refusal of the nobility to make any concessions, and under the pressure of the masses in Paris, with uprisings starting to develop in different parts of the country, the third estate decided to separate from the other orders, and they called themselves the National Assembly, the only representatives of the people. At a certain point, the king decided that this was going too far, and he decided to strike a blow at the National Assembly. He ordered troops to move into position around the capital, around Paris. And he was preparing to conduct a massacre of the people to put an end to this agitation. And that's the background to the uprising of July the 14th, 1789. Where the people rose up. They invaded the Invalides Palace in Paris. They took 28,000 guns out of the Invalides Palace and then went to the Bastille. Looking for arms. And finally the Bastille was taken by the people. And this attempted coup by the king was defeated. Now, July the 14th in Paris marked the beginning of this first phase of the revolution, and the movement spread out of the towns, out of Paris in particular, but out of the towns towards the countryside. This was the episode which is known as the Great Fear. Which was really a series of peasant uprisings. Because when the peasants heard of what had happened in Paris, they were afraid that there would be a reaction, a violent reaction by the aristocracy. And in fact, that violent reaction didn't really come, but they had taken arms, and when they moved into action, they attacked the manors and the castles, the residences of the nobility, and tried to destroy the papers which listed all the feudal rights. They didn't trust what the National Assembly, they didn't trust what was going on in Paris, and they took matters into their own hands. And with these castles and manor houses burning throughout the country, that was when we had this so-called night of the 4th of August in the National Assembly. By the way, the National Assembly had been renamed now. They called it the Constituent Assembly. And on this night of the 4th of August, the different representatives of the National Assembly stood up and renounced feudal rights and said that we should have no more tithes paid to the church, no more taxes on salt, no more privileges of this and that kind. They kind of gave up and abolished all these rights. That was because they were frightened of what was happening in the countryside, and they were trying to satisfy the masses, at least in words, so that the movement died down. But in fact, it was only in words. Because later on, the following year, when it came to rewrite all the laws about these feudal rights, what they had actually done is agreed to sell those rights. That is to say, instead of paying taxes to the lords every year, if you paid 20 years in advance, then you would they would lift the tax. So there would be no tax. And in fact, these feudal rights were only really abolished in the second phase of the revolution in 1792. So the events of July, the intervention of the masses, had forced the king to come to an arrangement with the National Assembly. Both the court and the National Assembly were in Versailles, far from the city. But in Paris and in the rest of the country, the problems were the same. There was still a shortage of bread, still desperate poverty. What a change for the people. You know, the Constituent Assembly, they draw up this very pompous document, the Declaration of the Rights of Man. But the positive elements in this declaration were never put into effect. And the people say, what use is the Declaration of the Rights of Man when there's nothing to eat? No bread, no work. Now, the deputies in the assembly, they were representatives of the bourgeoisie. They wanted to get concessions from the king, from the court, and take measures against the aristocracy. But they wanted to keep the people out of politics, keep the people in its place. And this first phase of the revolution ends with a very dramatic event in October 1789. When in this context of hunger and poverty, and unresolved problems. First of all, the people heard of a provocation against the people. Because a banquet organized by soldiers in Versailles, at this banquet, the soldiers had been doing a lot of drinking. These were the king's guards. And a regiment and a regiment of soldiers, the Flanders Regiment, which had been brought to Versailles. And in this banquet, the soldiers started singing royalist songs, and they took the revolutionary cockade out of their hats, and they stamped on the cockades underfoot and replaced them by white cockades of the monarchy. And that was a sign that at Versailles, things were not going well. And so on the 5th of October, a demonstration of 7,000 women, which was to demand bread in Paris, they decided to march to Versailles, which is about 20 miles away. I think it's 20 kilometres and 15 miles or so, like this. It's not far. Well, it's far, quite a long walk. 7,000 women, and they were followed by another detachment of 20,000 men and National Guards, all marched towards the palace in Versailles. To petition the National Assembly and the court for bread. And when the king appeared on the balcony of the palace, the crowds demanded that he accompany them back to Paris, that he should come back to Paris and be close to the people. And so you had this procession of about 30,000 people altogether, all marching from Versailles back to Paris, with the king in his carriage and the queen escorted by the people and put into the Tuileries Palace in Paris. So that event marks really the end of the first phase of the revolution. But what really had been achieved? The monarchy was maintained. Slavery was maintained. The right to vote was exclusively given to men of property. The population was divided by the National Assembly into active citizens, that is to say, rich citizens, and passive citizens, that is to say, the poor. The church lands were nationalised, that is to say, the state really took over the church lands, but then sold those lands to the wealthy landowners, to wealthy people. So that the poor peasantry gained nothing from that operation. And that then was the result, the meagre result, of July to October 1789. And so then the movement, the revolutionary movement, entered into a lull, receded. For as far as the bourgeoisie was concerned, the revolution was over. They had what they wanted. A compromise with the king. The feudal rights, as I said, were not abolished, but just put on sale. But as always happens in these cases, when the first wave of the revolution starts to recede, then the counter-revolution sees that as an opportunity to recover the former position. And here again, counter-revolution, trying to take advantage of this lull in the revolution, raised its head, And the situation turned around and a new phase of the revolution begins. When the royal family, who had been planning this for a long time, they left the king's palace in Paris during the night and moved to the east of France with the idea of linking up with reactionary armies and attacking Paris from the outside. But fortunately, the king was recognized at Varennes in the east of France. He was arrested and brought back to Paris as a prisoner. That was on the 20th of June, 1791. And this attempt of joining up with counter-revolutionary armies completely undermined this compromise with the king in the eyes of the people. They understood that this was not really a compromise and that as long as the king was there, there was a danger of counter-revolution. Now, the National Assembly tried to, the Constituent Assembly, they tried to, they were frightened that this counter-revolutionary act would provoke a new uprising of the people. And so they tried to hide the facts of what happened. They said that the king hadn't left of his own free will. He'd been kidnapped and taken abroad. This was what they said. And when a petition was presented, a demonstration was organized on the Champ de Mars to demand the end of the monarchy, Lafayette, the commander of the National Guard, opened fire on the crowds. And then after that, the Constituent Assembly, which was to draw up the new constitution, was replaced by the Legislative Assembly. Which was elected on the basis of this property qualification. But really this new assembly had to deal with all the same problems that the Constituent Assembly had. That is to say, to try and contain the revolutionary movement from below and preserve this compromise with the monarchy in spite of the flight to Varennes. Now, if we look at the composition of the Legislative Assembly, out of 745 deputies, 264 were right-wing constitutional monarchists, like Lafayette. 136 were associated with the Jacobin clubs. 136. Of which there was the very important Cordelier Club. The Cordelier Club was led by Danton. The 136 were associated with Jacobin clubs, and one of those clubs is a Cordelier Club. And that club was a very peculiar one because you could join it for free. There was no charge to join this club. And so that meant that that club was more sensitive to the pressure of the poor. And then the remaining deputies had no particular political affiliation. But Lafayette had the blood of the people on his hands after the Champ de Mars massacre. The king was discredited because of his attempt to escape. And so in society, opposition started to develop against the assembly and against the king. This was a period in which the Jacobin clubs really started to develop. From a single club in Paris to begin with, there were about 1,000 Jacobin clubs set up throughout the country. These were like debating societies that decided on actions and discussed politics, decided on what course to take in the revolution. And inside the Legislative Assembly, the pressure of this Jacobin movement and the general insurrectionary mood which was developing in Paris led to an increase in the influence of what were called the Gironde deputies. The Gironde is the region of France around Bordeaux. And these Gironde deputies, they represented the interests of the big bourgeoisie from the towns of Nantes, Bordeaux, Marseille, this kind of powerful capitalist. You could say that the Gironde was the party of capitalist law and order. They wanted to stop the revolution there, hold back the masses. They wanted to consolidate the gains of the revolution for the bourgeoisie, but they wanted to keep the masses out of action, out of politics. And also the Girondins were the Gironde deputies were the party of war. Because it was clear to the Gironde, to the bourgeoisie, that as long as there was a threat from Prussia, from Austria, from aristocratic Europe, and as long as there was an internal counter-revolutionary threat, they would never succeed in calming down the masses and establishing law and order in their interests. And therefore, they were for war in order to divert the attention of the masses against a foreign enemy. And therefore consolidate their position internally. And this question of the war and the unresolved social and economic questions, that's really the motor force of this second revolution. Just listen to what Engels says about the French Revolution. He says, the French Revolution is dominated by the war of coalition. All its pulsations depend upon it. When the coalition enters France, the revolutionary crisis sharpens. But when it retreats, the movement falls back and the reactionary elements come to the fore. So when in August 1791 this coalition was formed of aristocratic Europe against revolutionary France, this helped the Gironde to mobilize the masses against a foreign enemy. In their agitation for war, the Gironde presented the war as a revolutionary war. As a kind of a revolutionary crusade against aristocrats. And they said that this is the way to complete the revolution. But this agitation for war, this preparation for war by the Gironde deputies, coincided with the interests of the royal family also. Because the king, and of course Marie Antoinette, were in favour of war, because they knew that most of the commanders in the army were aristocrats, were close to the royal family. And the calculation of the royal family was that if this war takes place, then they would hope for a defeat on the basis of the betrayal of these aristocratic commanders. These commanders would then link up with foreign counter-revolutionary armies and move back to Paris to restore the royal authority. And so this war had an opponent in the Legislative Assembly. An opponent. An obstinate and clear-sighted opponent in the shape of Maximilien Robespierre. Now, Robespierre was one of the greatest revolutionary leaders of all time, a really great man. And practically alone, he opposed this movement towards the war, this preparation for war. Because he saw that the monarchy and the internal counter-revolution would take advantage of this so-called revolutionary war. First of all, it would take a lot of the revolutionary masses out of Paris towards the east to meet the foreign army. Secondly, this army was led by aristocratic generals. And if you like, it would shift the center of gravity from the masses to the bureaucracy, to the military bureaucracy. And the Girondin deputies would say, to Koblenz, let's attack aristocratic Europe. And in a very famous speech, Robespierre said, Koblenz, is there not also Paris? He said, is there not a relationship between Koblenz, where all the aristocratic commanders were, is there not a relationship between Koblenz and another place not far from here? He meant the royal palace. He said, if you think this is a war to complete the revolution, you'll be betrayed. He said, turn your eyes to your own internal position And do not go to face the enemy with other enemies at your back. But nobody listened to Robespierre much at that time. The king formed a government made up of the Gironde deputies. And war was declared on the 20th of April 1792. But events were to show that Robespierre's appraisal of the situation was absolutely correct. Here we had a poorly armed, ill-equipped army. Led by unreliable commanders, and the army went from defeat to defeat. Among the troops and among the masses, hostility to the generals and to the monarchy grew. Mutinies broke out. One general, General Dillon, was killed by his own soldiers. Dillon. And of all the officers involved in this campaign, one half of all the officers went over to the enemy. So now this created an extremely dangerous situation for the revolution, because you had the danger of these counter-revolutionary armies with all these French officers moving now towards Paris. The king dismissed the Girondin ministers and replaced them by the right-wing monarchists. And therefore there was a counter-revolutionary danger inside, from within Paris, and also from the outside. On top of that, there was a new counter-revolutionary provocation in the form of the Brunswick Manifesto by the Duke of Brunswick. As these armies prepared to advance against the revolution, the Duke of Brunswick said, "When we get to Paris, anybody who is in any way associated with the revolution will be subject to summary justice. That is to say, they'll be slaughtered." And it was this imminent perspective of a complete bloodbath, a massacre, which led to a new mass uprising. The Parisian sections of the National Guard, the sans-culottes, were moved in massively into these local sections, like kind of popular assemblies. They moved into the clubs and put pressure on the clubs. The National Guard was opened up to passive citizens, that is to say, to the poor. Revolutionary detachments started to move from different parts of the country towards Paris to defend the capital against the invaders. Anyone considered who was an officer in the army, who was considered as unreliable, who might betray, were purged out of the army. And 47 out of the 48 Parisian sections declared for the overthrow of the monarchy. And so on the night of the 9th of August, 1792, because the masses had no confidence in this legislative assembly, dominated by the monarchists and the Gironde, they formed a kind of a parallel government called the Insurrectionary Commune, and the following day, on the 10th of August, 1792, they attacked the king's palace and overthrew the monarchy. And the legislative assembly, which the king had been plotting against, instead of arresting the king, they actually took the king under their protection to protect him from the masses. But by that time, they had to recognize that the king was in a very, very difficult position. The Gironde, they didn't want to pronounce the end of the monarchy, but they said the monarchy is suspended temporarily. So as from the 10th of August 1792, the struggle in Paris is really between those who carried out the overthrow of the monarchy and those who couldn't prevent the overthrow of the monarchy, that is to say the Gironde. This assembly, this legislative assembly, it survived until the 20th of September for another month or so. But in reality, it no longer had any real power. Real power was in the hands of the insurrectionary commune. And the last period of the legislative assembly was marked by a struggle between the Gironde and this other fraction of deputies that were called the Mountain. They called them the Mountain because they used to sit on the higher seats in the assembly, so they had a commanding position in the assembly. Now, the leaders of the Mountain were the most outstanding representatives of the French Revolution. People like Marat, Robespierre, Danton, and Saint-Just. They were a minority in the assembly, but they had a mass base outside of the assembly in the support of the insurrectionary commune and in the support of the sections and the masses. So now that we're in this, the highest stage of the French Revolution, this is where the masses, who didn't listen to Robespierre to begin with, now they took his advice very seriously. Remember what he said, look to your own internal position and don't face the foreign enemy with the other enemies at your back. And so now this new insurrectionary movement, the masses took matters into their own hands. Any priests who would not support the revolutionary people were given 15 days to leave the country. Special people's courts were set up to try counter-revolutionaries. Any armed groups or forces inside the capital, which the people weren't sure of, were disarmed and arrested. house-to-house searches were carried out. Any speculators or profiteers, people trying to make money out of the shortage of food, they were arrested. Now, the Girondins in the assembly, they voted, they accepted all these measures. But they couldn't really do anything to stop them. This was the masses who had the initiative, who were in control of the situation. And the Girond just had to accept what was going on. Perhaps, on one occasion, the revolutionaries in the streets, they executed some counter-revolutionaries, and they put their heads on spikes, and they went into the assembly and showed these heads to the Girond deputy. Maybe that helped them in their reflection about what they did. Now this is also the period when the September massacres took place. This was when detachments of the poorest sections of the population went into the prisons. Because they had heard that when the counter-revolutionary armies got to Paris, they would open the prisons and use criminals and so on to assassinate the people. So there was a very improvised tribunals were set up in the prisons, and something like, I've seen different figures, maybe 1,100, maybe 1,400 people were put to death. Now this was a very grim episode in the revolution. No doubt some of these people were not counter-revolutionaries. Well, what you have to bear in mind is, for the masses, this was a life and death situation. In a matter of days or weeks, the revolution would be decided, and it was a question of life or death for them. Just before the September massacres, the fortress town of Verdun had fallen to the enemy. Because one of the government's generals, Dumouriez, betrayed and went over to the enemy. And once Verdun had fallen, the way was open towards Paris. So for the masses, they'd been betrayed one time by the Girondins, they weren't going to take any chances this time. Now this mass pressure, this mass struggle, the people called it dictatorship. It was a dictatorship of the poor masses against the rich and powerful who'd betrayed them. It was under this dictatorship of the sans-culottes, that is to say, the common people. That at last feudal rights were finally abolished, really abolished. That measures were taken to relieve the poor at the expense of the rich. That the distinction between active citizens and passive citizens was abolished. And it's also in this time that slavery was abolished in the colonies. The uprisings of the slaves in Saint-Domingue under the leadership of Toussaint Louverture now found support in the revolutionary armies from Paris that went over to help the slaves fight against the slave owners. And on the military plane, on the military level, this victorious uprising and dictatorship of the masses changed everything. Instead of a military campaign like with the Gironde led by aristocratic generals, now the war was a war of social liberation. And this war of social liberation had a colossal effect on the consciousness of the peoples of the entire continent. This was now a genuine people's army under the control of the people. And the effect that this had, even on the troops of the foreign dukes and kings and princes who were arraigned against the revolution, was seen at the Battle of Valmy, a very important event, which was on the 20th of September, 1792. These were Prussian troops. The Prussian army was the most deadly and efficient military machine on the continent. With disciplined, highly trained and well-armed soldiers. And when this army, aristocratic army, led by aristocrats, met the revolutionary army at Valmy in the east of France, in the Ardennes, the Prussian soldiers, they could see an army like they'd never seen before. Okay, they didn't have fancy uniforms and they weren't very well armed. It was almost more like a demonstration than a military advance. Actually, the French soldiers, put their hats on their bayonets and held their hats up with their bayonets and just shouted, "Liberty, liberty, liberty." Singing revolutionary songs and chanting revolutionary slogans to the soldiers that they were facing. These are very young people, inexperienced soldiers. The Prussians fired the cannons into the soldiers, but the lines didn't break. And also the French general, a man called Kellermann, instead of being behind the lines and watching how the battle was going, he was at the front on his horse leading the men. And the Duke of Brunswick could see the effect this was having on his own soldiers. And to prevent them from going over to the revolutionary side, he withdrew his troops into Belgium. So that was a great victory for the French Revolution. And that victory had a colossal effect on the Parisian masses, boosted their confidence, and aroused the French people to their feet even further. This at last now, instead of being under threat, the revolution was striking blows against the enemy. And one man who was present on the battlefield was Wolfgang von Goethe. He was there at Valmy. And he wrote something about that day, which is now actually on a monument in Valmy, on the battlefield. He said, "On this day and in this place begins a new era in the history of the world." So the victory at Valmy was followed by others, at Jemappes, other battles. And this victory coincided with the election of the National Convention, which replaced the Legislative Assembly. The difference was that now the election was without a property qualification. But nonetheless, because the provinces were generally lagging behind Paris, the majority was still for the Gironde. But once again, a Gironde majority, but under the red-hot pressure of the masses. On the very first day of the convention meeting, the monarchy was abolished. Now, it's true there was still the threat from counter-revolutionary armies abroad. And also there was an uprising in the Vendée in the south-west of France. A counter-revolutionary rising. And therefore it was necessary for the revolution to concentrate all efforts on the military front. And place the conduct of the war in the hands of the most resolute defenders of the revolution. People like Marat, Robespierre, Saint-Just, and Danton. These men were the most consistent expression of the revolutionary pressure of the masses. All of them were great leaders and great propagandists. If you're looking for inspiration, political inspiration, read the speeches of Robespierre or Saint-Just. Absolutely magnificent speeches. These people knew how to talk to the masses and how to express the feelings of the masses. It was Marat in particular who had a kind of a nose for counter-revolutionary plots and any dangers which might be facing the revolution. He was constantly alerting the masses through his paper, the L'Ami du Peuple. Watch this individual, watch that individual. He was a kind of a watchdog of counter-revolutionary intrigue. And on one occasion, the Gironde accused him. They said, "You're the man who's responsible for this dictatorship, this violent dictatorship." Well, But Mara took that as a compliment. He said, I must be the first ever of all political writers and perhaps the only person in France who from the very beginning of this revolution has proposed dictatorship as the only means of crushing traitors and conspirators. So anyway, the Gironde had a majority in the convention, and they tried to lead a kind of a rear guard action to, they had to go along with the mass movement to a large extent, but they tried to hamper the mass movement and stop it from going too far. So you had a situation in which there was food shortages and poverty, and the Girondes were trying to protect the interests of the rich and the powerful. And Robespierre said of them, they want a republic for themselves, he said, to govern in the interests of the rich. Now, the revolution required draconian measures in order to conduct the war. Measures against free enterprise and profiteering. Controls were put on prices. Resources were requisitioned. The masses wanted to decide what was produced and in what quantity, for what purpose. And the Committee of Public Safety, the kind of governmental committee which was at the head of this movement, said that whilst they respected the rights of private property interests should be subordinate to the public interest. So this was a war economy in which the masses who were involved in a life and death struggle at home and abroad, they kind of held the capitalists by the throat, if you like, to get the resources necessary to conduct the war. But finally, with the sabotage of the Gironde trying to hold back the revolutionary energy of the masses, that led to a final uprising on the 31st of May. And after 3 days of insurrection, the convention was purged of all the Gironde deputies and left the mountain in control. Now, this expulsion of the Gironde led to a generalization of the civil war. Who started to wage an armed struggle against the revolution from the provinces. And so under this military threat, again, we saw how the masses tried to take things under control. They wanted to veto any contracts by factories and things which weren't related to the war effort or which weren't satisfying the needs of the people.
Masse e esigenze della guerra.
And this was combined with a levy en masse, that is to say, a mass mobilization recruitment to form a massive people's army on a greater scale than before. And these gigantic revolutionary efforts got results. Lyon and Bordeaux, which had fallen to the Gironde, were taken back in the autumn of 1793. Toulon was taken in December. And at that same time, the insurrection in the Vendée was finally defeated. And then on the 26th of June, 1794, at the end of this revolutionary war, the victory at the Battle of Fleurus in Belgium finally eradicated any serious threat on France's eastern borders. Now, from that date, from the end of the war with the Battle of Fleurus, this is where the revolution starts to enter into decline. Remember what Engels said about the relationship between the war and the revolution? That when the counter-revolutionary threat was present, that pushed the revolution forward, and when the counter-revolutionary threat was removed, the revolution calmed down. And this is what happened. The easing of the military situation led to a change in the relationship between the classes in Paris itself. The terror directed against the counter-revolution and the exceptional measures of the war economy lost their justification. And the mass movement started to recede. There was also an element of exhaustion in the masses, as you can imagine. Especially because after such titanic efforts, when the revolutionary army started to be demobilized, the revolutionaries came back to a situation not very different to what they'd had before. Poverty, the difficulties of everyday life, and all unemployment, and in the countryside, the same situation as before. At least for the poorest sections of society. And therefore the movement declined and people slid back into inactivity. So the Robespierre regime lost the support of the masses. The revolutionary government, finding that it was losing its basis in society, they directed blows against the counter-revolution, against the right, but also against the left. And finally, Robespierre was overthrown on the 9th of Thermidor in 1794. The 9th of Thermidor was the 27th of July. That's the 27th of July.
Thermidor era il capitale rivoluzionario.
Robespierre was executed the following day without even the pretense of a trial. Together with more than 90 Robespierristes. They were all guillotined. And so from that point on, France kind of slides into counter-revolution. Which finally led to the dictatorship of Napoleon in 1799. And with the defeat of Napoleon at the end of the Napoleonic Wars, in 1814 and 1815, the monarchy was finally restored. But this was a monarchy on a new foundation, on the foundation of bourgeois rule. So, this was the French Revolution. It was a bourgeois revolution from beginning to end. Although, as I said, it wasn't carried out by the bourgeoisie. I think that's clear. This is what Karl Marx said about the way things happen. He said, the bourgeoisie was really the class at the head of the movement. Even where the lower classes acted against the bourgeoisie, as in 1793 to 94, they were only really struggling to bring about the triumph of the bourgeoisie. Although not with the methods of the bourgeoisie. He says the whole of the terror in France was nothing more than a plebeian method of eradicating the enemies of the bourgeoisie. Absolutism and feudalism. Now, given the development of the productive forces at that time, there could be no question of socialism. These masses which carried out the revolution were not like a modern working class. The working class, the wage-earning class, only really existed in an embryonic form at the time. And therefore, it was impossible for the revolution to go any further at that stage. But in any case, this revolution was a titanic struggle of the oppressed. People driven by the hope of a world free of oppression. Of inequality and exploitation. And their struggle, therefore, is part of our heritage. Now, I say a world free of oppression because the French Revolution is often presented as a national event. But this is not the case. It's interesting that in the Constitution of 1793, drawn up at the height of the revolution, this constitution doesn't even mention France. It speaks of humanity, of the brotherhood of all peoples, of a universal republic, and the common struggle of all the oppressed against all tyrants. And this is also our aim. And now under modern conditions, where the working class assures all the fundamental functions of society, all the main functions, we are heading for a new revolution which will open the way for a new social order in which these ideals of liberty, equality and fraternity will no longer be the hypocritical masquerade they are under capitalism. You know, there was one of the newspapers in revolutionary Paris was called Révolution de Paris. The editor was a man called Élisée Loustalot. And the subtitle on his paper was this: Les grands ne paraissent grands que parce que nous sommes à genoux, levons-nous. The great only appear great because we are on our knees. Let us rise.
Comrades, we've got a few minutes before the official break time at 5 o'clock.